gives me great pleasure and honor to present our speaker of this afternoon, who was a member of the original AA group in Los Angeles, a former GSO delegate, and a former Alcoholics Anonymous trustee. The rest of the horrible details he can fill in for himself. I give you Cliff.
My name's Cliff Walker, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm completely delighted, happy, and grateful to have been able to attend and participate in this conference. I got here yesterday afternoon and have made most of the meetings. And I would like to add my personal thanks to the committee for such a wonderful job. It's been one of the finest conferences I've ever attended. And of course, I view these things usually from two standpoints. One, what I think the newcomer will think of it, and also what I personally get out of it. And I must say this has scored high on both accounts. And thanks very much. And my congratulations for a job well done. But I know to put one of these things together takes an awful lot of hard chore work. A lot of meetings, a lot of details. Of course, we come to conferences and everything's all set up. The lights are turned on, the speakers are arranged for, the food and coffee's prepared. But to get that done and get it to run smoothly is an immense job. So I know what you've been through, and I think you've earned all the gratitude that we can possibly give you. I'd like to pay an especially warm welcome to any of you that might be new or fairly new to our society of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sincerely hope that something I can say or do might be beneficial to you. But I want you to know, if I don't help you at all, by allowing me to come here and share my experiences with you is doing a great deal for me personally. Some wise man once said that people who fail to remember the experiences of the past are condemned to relive them. And I have found that a particularly truism of us alcoholics. If we fail to remember our past experiences, we're apt to relive them, aren't we? And certainly if we share those experiences with others, we're bound to remember them. That's why after almost 24 years of being on this program, when anybody asks me to talk, I consider it a great privilege. And I know that it's ensuring my own sobriety, one of the things that ensure it. So I'm grateful to you new people and to all of you for listening. Bill, the original member of Alcoholics Anonymous, once said that Alcoholics Anonymous is spiritually as well as morally centered. That practically every AA member, sooner or later, comes to believe in and depend upon a higher power, which most of us call God. Now, experience has taught us that seldom, if ever, is permanent recovery from alcoholism achieved without taking this all-important step of faith. God, as we understand him then, is literally the foundation upon which our society rests. And I'm sure that every AA member that's been around very long would heartily endorse that statement. But I'm equally sure that many of you here today have had some difficulties with that step, the step of faith, coming to believe. And through the years, we've found a lot of these very worldly lushes that come in here make a tremendous hurdle out of this thing, a barrier, an impossible hurdle to get over. And it's understandable. What do we do? A new guy or gal comes in, and what do we tell them? We say, well, through our eyes and experience, we show them that they have a progressive fatal illness. And we say alcoholism, a disease of a twofold nature, an obsession of the mind coupled with an allergy of the body. And then we go on to say, now, experience has shown us, and the medical profession back us up, that nothing can ever be done about this physical part of our disease, this allergy. So far, medical science, as wonderful as they are, have never found a pill, an antibiotic, a wonder drug that will remove this physical thing that we have. We've got it, and we'll have it forever. Then we go on to say that we in AA have found that the solution to this thing is not in the body, it's in our mind. We have to find a way of living that doesn't demand the first drink. We have to work upon the obsession. So the new lust says, well, how did you get rid of this obsession? This all-powerful obsession. Well, we say, we've tried all the man-made cures. We tried everything on earth in AA, but we found that there was no power on earth strong enough to remove this obsession that we have for booze. The power had to come from above, an outside power, a higher power that most of us call God. Well, for the spiritually susceptible and receptive, sometimes that isn't too difficult a thing to swallow. But for the atheist, the agnostic-minded, or the antagonistic-minded lushes, it's sometimes a pretty rough hole, row to hoe, isn't it? Certain our experiences taught us that. It seems to me that this is a part of our lives that a lot of us should share more, perhaps, how we came to believe. So I thought this afternoon I would like to share with you a chapter out of my AA life of recovery. That part of my life where I came to believe. Now, I'm not saying this the way everybody should do it. Not at all. But I'm one of those that believe that God has no grandchildren. Just children. And this step of faith, I think, has to be taken with our Maker. But perhaps in telling my story, perhaps it'll show somebody else who is having difficulties that it's not so tough. You know, this is a part of my AA life of recovery I used to didn't talk about for a long time. I mean, I guess I was a little ashamed or embarrassed about it. And when I would speak of it, it would be almost apologetic. But one time something happened that made me see that this is something I should share. In Whittier, my home group, one night I went to the meeting, and before the meeting, a fella come up to me, one of our newer people. And he says, Cliff, I understand you've been around a while. And he says, I've got to have an answer to a question. He said, I joined your group here about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And Cliff, he says, I've been completely enthralled with what I found here. I mean, you people are so wonderful and friendly and cheerful. And with all my heart, I want what you have. He says, alcohol just destroyed my life. He says, last week I had saved up enough money to buy the big book. And he says, ever since I've been reading it and studying it, and he says, I think it's wonderful. But he says, Clef, I am intelligent enough to know that the crux of this thing is spiritual. Coming to believe in a higher power, God. He said, Clef, with all my heart, I would like to believe and have faith and all that, but I can't. He says, my folks were hard-shelled Baptists. And they taught me about a revengeful God that would punish me horribly for all the sins that I committed. And in my childhood, I developed a hatred and fear of the word God. And he says, I know I still have it. I know it's immature and childish perhaps, but it's there. And I don't think this is something I can ever come to believe in. He said, Clef, now I want a straight answer. Does that mean that I am to be one of the 25% that you people speak of that can't make this program? Well, just then, the meeting was called to order by the chairman. Don Whittier, I'm an old-timer. They never asked me to talk, and I like it that way. But this particular night, the chairman got up and he said, well, our speakers didn't show up tonight, so I guess we'll have to make this one of those anticipation meetings. He said, I see a guy sitting there that's an old-timer. I'd like to have a few words from him. Cliff, would you come up and say a few words? You know, I got up and I literally ran to that podium because I had something to say. And I told this newfound friend he had nothing to worry about. That perhaps 50% of our membership was the same way. That we rejected this thing at first glance. A lot of us thinking it was the sawdust trail again. And I told him about me. I told him how I'd been a preacher's son back in Kansas. How I'd been raised in a church. How when I was a small child I had to go to all the church meetings. Sunday school, church in the morning, Christian Endeavor at night. All the services, I had to go to every funeral and every wedding. You know, I still dislike both. You know, I should have won the big wedding. We ran off to Las Vegas and got married like decent people should. But I loved my father and mother, I did. But I was a rebel by nature. And I did these things to please them as I grew older. But deep inside, I developed a tremendous resentment against anything spiritual, anything smacking of religion. And I swore, whenever I left home, I would never darken the door of a church again. And I didn't. But what happens? Through the years, I become an alcoholic of the worst kind. In 1939, I was at the end of the alcoholic trail for people. The medical profession had classed me the hopeless variety of alcoholic. There was no cure for drinkers like me. And they literally told Dorothy, if you want your husband to stay alive, you're going to have him completely and totally confined. But you know, I had something then that very few people had. I had a wife who knew I was sick. You know, alcoholism in those days was not a very popular sickness. You didn't get all these articles about alcoholism, the disease. But Dorothy somehow sensed that I was sick. And was always trying to help me find a way out. And we tried many things. I won't go into some of them, but they were dismal failures. Until early 1940, Dorothy found AA for me. Through a series of the most remarkable correspondence. I was in touch with AA. And I attended the first meeting, the open meeting in Los Angeles on Skid Row, early 1940. And at that original meeting, the fellow that started didn't know how, had never been to an AA meeting. He didn't know how to begin it. So he could think of nothing else to do but to read the 12 steps. Now here is this rebellious, antagonistic preacher's son. And what do I hear in our 12 steps? I hear God mentioned several times. And I went to about four of those meetings or five, and every meeting they'd start reading those 12 steps. Till finally I had enough. And I told them very frankly. I said, I don't like the 12 steps. Why do you read them? I've heard them once. I've heard them five times. Somebody says, well, why don't you like them, Cliff? I said, well, I'll tell you why. They're not pertinent to my problem. I said, you know, my only problem is I drink too much. When I don't drink, my wife says I'm a pretty nice guy. But all that God business particularly, I can't stomach it. And all that other stuff is just not pertinent to my problem. Well, in those days, nobody could give you any good advice because they didn't have any experience either. But after the meeting, a guy came up to me and he says, Cliff, I'll tell you something about the 12 steps. He says, you don't have to take them all. Just take one step you really like. And you practice that the best of your ability, and he says, you'll stay sober. Well, you know, I kind of like that. But being a gambler at heart, I thought, I like the odds in my favor. I'll take two steps. So I took the first and the last, I thought. And I became a good two-stepper. But any of you new people here, I want to suggest something to you. Be careful who you take advice from. This little guy that gave me that good advice, he'd only been to one meeting before that. And his advice damn near killed me. Because not too long after that, I got taken drunk. And I got on the worst binge of my entire career. You know what made it so bad? It was listening to all these drinking experiences of these fellows around me. They told me so much about drinking I'd never known before. Where to hide bottles. How to get money. These ingenious drunks had really got me in a lot of new angles that were completely new to me. And I had to try them all. And this actually happened. A guy had told me, or in the meeting, he'd say, you know, when I'd start on a binge, he said, I'd always mail myself money. He says, two or three days after, you know, I've started, when I really need this money, here through the mail would come this money, and boy, that would save my life. Well, I tried it, and it worked out real well. But another thing that made it so bad was the demoralization. Here, Dottie and I, and particularly Dorothy, had had such high hopes for AA. And then for to have it fail, as I thought then, it was a horrible experience. And another thing. At the first meeting that I attended there in Los Angeles, there was a fellow named Gordon who had came all the way from Phoenix, Arizona, to find out about AA. Or anything else that would cure him of alcoholism. He and his wife had come over. And Gordon had come to this meeting, the first meeting, the same as I. Only Gordon had misinterpreted something along the line because he thought he was supposed to come drunk to his first meeting. But he had overdone it. So he passed out before the meeting started. But you know, the next meeting, Friday night, Gordon came to the meeting sober. And he stayed sober. And Dottie and I got friendly with Gordon and his wife. Then Gordon found it necessary to go back to Phoenix. Well, from Phoenix, Gordon's wife began writing Dorothy these glowing letters. How well Gordon was doing. He'd changed. The kids no longer feared him. He'd earned the respect of the people around him. He had a new job. Everything was just roses. Pardon. You can imagine the impact of those letters on the Walker household, which was in shambles. Here I am on the worst binge of my entire career. At that time, I was holding precariously on to a milkman's job. But very precariously. But you know, I have one of those obsessive, compulsive type personalities. I always have that. I get fixed ideas. And I got to thinking about Gordon staying sober over in Phoenix, Arizona. And I remember, gee, he didn't even have enough decency to come to his first meeting sober. I had. I remember this little, skinny, scrawny guy. I knew he wasn't as smart as I was. He wasn't as good looking. Not as strong. And yet he's staying sober without even AA around him. Wonder why. Well, the inevitable happened. One day, I disappear. The milk truck disappears. The money disappears. And you know where we all wound up, don't you? Phoenix, Arizona. The drunkest, dirtiest milkman you ever saw. From a Phoenix, Arizona bar called Gordon. And Gordon, God bless him. Came and got me. And he took me home. And he cleaned me up. And he washed me up. And when he got me somewhat lucid, I got Gordon in the corner and I popped the $64,000 question. I said, Gordon, what keeps you sober? Gordon looked me right square in the eye and he says, Cliff, you're not going to like this, but I'm going to give it to you straight. I'm staying sober because I have placed my drinking problem in the hands of a power greater than myself that I call God. And he says, I use that power not only for sobriety, but for direction in everything that I do. I looked Gordon right back in the face and I said, Gordon, do you mean that I've come 500 miles on a milk truck to get this God business again? It won't work with me. It just won't work. And I believed it. Gordon didn't go any further. He said, Cliff, that's it. That night, Gordon put me on a truck. One of those great big express trucks that travel in the middle of the night from Phoenix to L.A. carrying express. And coming on that back from Phoenix on that truck in the dead of night, this guy hit bottom. For the first time in my life, I hit bottom. You new people will hear that expression quite often in AA, and you'll say, what do you mean? I don't know. All I can tell you is what happened to me. To me, it was a flash of insight about myself I had never had before. I suddenly saw my drinking in all its sordidness. I saw suddenly that I was destroying not only my life, but the life of my wife and kids who I adored. I finally saw that I was a complete and total failure at the business of living. And I had a sense of depression and hopelessness, the likes of which I've never had before or since. And believe me, I almost threw myself out on the speeding highway. I just wanted to end it all. I was so desolate. And then the thought struck me, there must be a way out for me. Must be. And then, suddenly, I made the decision that became the turning point in my life. And it was simply this. I would go back to Los Angeles and go back to AA if they would have me. And whatever they wanted me to do, whether I liked it or not, I would do it. I felt this was the only possible chance for me. You see, I'd finally reached the attitude of mind that all desperately sick people reach. The cancer patient or the tubercular. Who know they are sick unto death. They'll grasp at anything to survive. And that's the way it was with me. It opened my mind. As Bill once said, there's nobody so open-minded as the dying. So I come back to Los Angeles. I went back to AA. But with a completely different attitude. When I got into this big book, it was altogether different. Before that, I wasn't particularly interested in the forepart. I kind of liked the stories in the back. But this time, I began to get this healing communication, that's AA, of one drunk talking to another. You know, you've heard Bill talk about the language of the heart. Communication in depth. And the thing that he and Dr. Bob had learned the hard way, that there is no real communication in depth until the sponsor and the sponsee not only have a equal need of each other, but an awareness, a deep awareness of that need. Once that is achieved, there is a two-way communication. And that's when I learned and could receive this communication. When I knew my desperate need for AA. Well, this time I could see myself on every page. When they were describing the alcoholic, they're describing me. And I got a real knowledge and awareness of what was wrong with me. And I might say to any of you here, new or old, if you're having difficulties with your spiritual life, I would first find out in depth what is the nature of alcoholism. How sick you really are. You know what Bill says in one of his writings? He says about the 12 steps, he says it's idealistic, the program. None of us could ever possible practice these 12 steps to perfection. And he says there's only one step that could be taken 100%. And that's the first one. And he says, in my opinion, it should be. And he says, goes on further to say, I mean that 100% admission of powerlessness over booze. William James or somebody once wrote that the first step towards spiritual living or spiritual experience or awakening is surrender. In AA, we call it hitting bottom. I think they're one and the same. So it's extremely important that each one of us identify properly with Alcoholics Anonymous and its people, who admittedly have a progressive fatal illness, that for us to drink is to die. And I know I never started anywhere until that came upon me, that I was dying or going mad. Not this time. This time, I could no more take the second and third step than a man in the world. And I went to my sponsors, and Frank and Mort, and I told them, I'd like to believe, but I don't. Not as far as I'm concerned. I can't take these steps yet. So Frank and Mort says, well, what's the hurry? What's the hurry? One thing they said in the second step. It didn't say we believe. It says we came to believe. And it didn't say how long it took. Take your time. Then Frank, my tough sponsor, said, Cliff, you know, I have a suggestion to make. Why don't you forget about the God business and start cleaning up your own house? He says, you know something, Cliff? You have an awful dirty house. He says, I think if you worked the rest of your life cleaning on that house, you'd never get it entirely clean. He says, why don't you start on that four step, the action steps? And then he admonished me. He said, Cliff, if you take a step in AA of any kind, or try to, give it all you got. Be thorough, painstaking. Remember, he says, you're dealing with the most important business on earth, your own life, your own welfare. So if you take a step, be thorough, honest, painstaking. It's well worthwhile. If you're not ready to be that, drop it. So then I started out. I was still anything but fond of the 12 steps. I still didn't like them. I still didn't want to do it. But I knew through sheer necessity I had to do it. I had no other choice. And my figuring kind of went this way. Well, I'll never have any help from this greater power. How could any divine presence be interested in me of all the things I've done? So then, my only possible chance for survival is to do the other steps twice as good as anybody else. So that's the way I went at it. And when I took an inventory, brother, I took an inventory. I wrote on every sheet of paper in the house, and I think some on the walls. And I wrote and I wrote and I wrote. And I know it must have been a rather inadequate inventory as I think back. But you know, when I took this inventory and began to look at it and read it over, it suddenly dawned on me there was a lot more wrong with Cliff than just drinking. When I really saw some of these things on paper. And another conclusion arrived. This was much later, of course. You know, I don't know how about the rest of you, but in my drinking, when it got serious, like so many human beings, I had to justify it. I had to justify it. I mean, the terrible things I did. And I justified my drinking on the conditions around me. I'd say, well, if I hadn't broken my leg playing frost football for the Trojans, I would have completed my education and I'd have been a more successful person. Or I'd say, if my boss understood me and knew what an intelligent guy I was, or that's the cause of it. Or if I had a new job, or if we moved to another place. Or I'd say, I probably need a different kind of wife who would understand me. But I always blamed it on conditions around me. They would only change. And I really believed this, I thought, if somebody would die and leave me $1 million, I'd have no drinking problem. The conditions. One thing I've learned in AA, the conditions are always there. Living is meeting problems and solving them. We have death, bereavements, we have tragedies. Every human being has that to go through. There'll always be the conditions. What AA has taught me, that I can change myself to meet the conditions, whatever they are. And they change us to meet conditions, not the conditions themselves. Through the years, we found AAs, after they have been indoctrinated into it and learn how to practice these principles, can meet any conditions and survive them. It works under any circumstances. Thank God. Anyway, at this point in my life, I'm frantically working the 12 steps. Most of them didn't mean a great deal to me. I still didn't like them. But I'm taking them. I took my, God, one of the worst things, hardest thing for me to ever do was to go to another person and tell them the nature of my wrongs, the defects of character. I brought out things that I thought would never see the light of day again. And I was horribly embarrassed. And you know, the only reason I did it, because the book said, seldom can we stay permanently sober if we don't get rid of everything. But that's the way I'm working, just to try to do it the way the book says. One day, I called up my sponsor, my tough sponsor, Frank. I said, Frank, I said, you know how hard I've been working on these 12 steps and trying to stay sober since I got back from Phoenix. He said, yes. I said, you know, I've run into something I can't cope with. It's something I can't do. He said, well, what is it? I said, well, I'm into the eighth and ninth step, making amends. And I've made, sent letters and gone to people, and I've had fairly good response, but the book says something that I should do that I can't do. It says that I should go to my creditors and tell them what happened. And I said, Frank, you know I can't do that. He says, after all, when I went to Phoenix, I took about $800 of the company's money. I says, I owe the bonding company for that. I said, I owe several hundred dollars for groceries. I owe back rent. I owe $100 on a $50 Ford. Not only that, Frank, I says, I'm not only unemployed, I'm unemployable. People won't have me. I said, Frank, you know what I think I ought to do? With such a weight of debt, and this is still Depression days, I think I ought to go to South America and start all over. So you know what Frank said? He said, well, Cliff, you can do that. Go ahead. But I want to tell you something. When you get off the boat in South America, at the end of the gangplank, the first guy you're going to run into is Cliff Walker. He says, you know, you've been running away from that guy for years. He says, don't you think, Cliff, it's about time you face up to the guy? He said, Cliff, when you come back from Phoenix, you told me that you'd do anything to stay sober. You'd go to any lengths. Did you mean it? I said, yeah, I really did, Frank, and I still do. He says, will you follow a suggestion I have? I said, well, yes, I'll try. He said, I want you to get up tomorrow morning, go down to the bonding company, and tell them what happened. I said, Frank, you mean I should go down there and tell them that I got drunk and run off of this milk truck and all that money that they had to pay back? I said, Frank, they'll throw me in jail. I can still hear Frank say, so what? So what? He says, you want to live or you want to die? I said, okay, Frank, I'll go. So the next morning I get up, kiss my wife and two boys fondly farewell, go downtown to Spring Street, about five trips around the block getting up my courage. Finally, I got up enough steam, I walked in, and they showed me into a room with this little guy sitting there. Of course, I'm steamed up and ready to go, and I walk in. I says, my name is Cliff Walker. I'm an alcoholic. I got drunk. I spent $700 that you had to pay back, and I says, I want you to know I'm ready for jail. The guy kind of grinned. He said, well, sit down a minute first, will you? So we talked a while, you know, and I told him about what I was trying to do. And finally he says, you know, Mr. Walker, he says, you're not the only guy that ever got in trouble. A lot of people do for the same things. In fact, here's a dandy, and he pulled a card out of the desk, and he says, this guy really got in trouble. He says, he owes us $45,000. And he says, you want to know something? At the rate he is paying us off, we figure it'll take us 980 years to get our money. So, Mr. Walker, if we threw you in jail, we couldn't collect a dime from you. He said, how much could you pay us in good faith? He said, well, I'm unemployed and unemployable. And I rattle off all these debts. I said, I do get $18 a week Social Security. I thought, well, I've had it. He says, well, I want to ask you something. Could you pay us 50 cents a week in good faith? I said, well, sure, I could do that. He says, you pay us 50 cents a week in good faith and we won't bother you. You know, when I walked out of this office, I began to change. When I'd walked in, I was still the rebel, still defiant. I was sure that SOB would throw me in jail, but Frank says to go to him, I'll go. But when I walked out, this character had started to change. Prior to this, I was just taking the 12 steps because I had to. Not because I wanted to, because I said I had to do it for my chance of sobriety, but nothing had hit me. But today, it started, and it began to change me. And I got to thinking, well, boy, maybe there's something to all this, being honest, off the oats box stuff. Well, I hadn't quite changed enough, I guess, because some of the skepticism come back and the cynicism. I thought, well, maybe he was just an extra nice kind of a guy. I better not make any big decisions about this. I better go to some others. And I thought about near where I lived of a little Jewish grocer. A little Jewish grocer who I absolutely despised. I hated him with everything that was in me. Not because he was Jewish, but because I owed him $200 back grocery. He had never bothered me, never bothered. Yet in my mind, I could feel him putting a squeeze on me. And I had a deep-seated resentment against this man. I thought, boy, if it'll work with him, it will work with anybody. So while I'm all charged up, I go right out to San Vicente and Melrose. And I go into this Jewish grocery store. And I finally get my little Jewish friend, now a friend, aside. And I say to him, Mr. So-and-so, you probably don't know this, but I'm an alcoholic. He says, you're telling me. Surprising how many people know, isn't it? I said, I owe you a great deal of money. I can't pay you. But I want you to know I recognize the debt. And when I can, I'll start paying you back. You know what that little Jewish grocer did? He put his arm around my shoulder. And he said, Mr. Walker, I think you're wonderful. I think you're wonderful. He says, you know, when most people owe me money and they can't pay, they move away or they evade me. But you come in here and look me right square in the eye and say you're a drunkard, but you can't pay. That's the finest thing, he said, that's ever happened to me. And I broke down and I tried to tell him what I was trying to do and what we were trying to do in AA. It was just a handful of us. We didn't know whether it would work permanently or not, but this was our only chance of survival. And he was enthralled with it. And as I started to leave, he called me back and he said, Mr. Walker, don't worry about the money you owe me. Don't worry at all.
Furthermore, he says, this is depression times. You're going to have a tough time getting a job. If you need more credit to feed those kids, you come in here. He says, with me, your credit is unlimited. Oh, man, when I walked out in front of that store, this guy had really begun to change. I'd learned probably one of the greatest lessons of my A life that day from that little Jewish friend. One of the greatest. And you know what it was? How to master resentment. You know what the book says? It says that resentment probably kills more alcoholics than any other one thing. And that the harms people do us, whether they are imaginary or real, have the same power to destroy us. That little Jewish grocer had never harmed me in all his life. But in my mind, he had. And that would have destroyed me had I not gone and faced up to the guy the way I had and put it right on the line. And I'll be forever grateful to that little Jewish grocer for receiving me the way he did, because it gave me the courage then to go on. I went to all my creditors. Dorothy and I were paying off debts at the rate of 15 and 20 cents a week. Debts running into the hundreds. Hard coal finance people, we call them. And let's use more or less the same approach. Every piece of furniture we had in our house was bought on the down payment plan, $1 a month and so forth. And it was quite a remarkable experience for me, who had lost his complete faith in people, who was almost completely cynical. But you know what was happening? I was still going to the meetings. Still going to meetings, wondering when I was going to have my spiritual experience. I mean, I wanted one, like the book said. I wanted one like Bill's, one of these spectacular kind, with the room lighting up and all this stuff. Nothing happens. Nothing happens. 2 years go by, and no spiritual experience. I'm beginning to harp on it in the meetings. But one day, I'm sitting in my room, trying to take the 10th and 11th step, particularly the 10th, looking over my inventory and how I'm progressing. This particular day, it just occurred to me that I had been sober a little over 2 years. I mean, I'd never thought about it before at the time. Not only that, I suddenly realized that I hadn't even thought of a drink for over a year. I hadn't even dreamed of getting drunk for over 6 months. Boy, that's quite remarkable. And then all of a sudden I realized that I also had changed. I mean, things that used to throw me weren't bothering me anymore. I was getting along at home. I was getting along with others. Boy, that's remarkable. Dottie and I had tried all the philosophies and psychiatry and all that stuff. It never helped me. And all of a sudden I realized those haunting fears had begun to go. Here I had been the most painfully shy kind of a guy you could ever want. Believe me. You know, I was in AA for 2 years and never had enough guts to get up and read the 12 steps. But the last Friday I'd got up and read the 12 steps, I was beginning to be free of fear. And then all of a sudden I realized I couldn't have done this by myself. Somewhere along, an intelligence greater than mine had been at work. Something outside me. And all of a sudden there was awareness of a higher power. I mean, a sudden realization and awareness that I'd had some help. Not a spectacular room lighting affair. All of a sudden I believed. I had what I think William James calls the garden variety of spiritual experience, slow growth and awakening. But all of a sudden, I came to believe.
You know, probably a lot of you remember this Russian astronaut that encircled the globe 17 times. He come over to America, and some of our press people ask him, "Well, while you were circling the globe, did you happen to see God up there?" And the Russian said, "No." He says, "I looked everywhere. I didn't see God up there." It reminded me of something rather funny that happened at Whittier. One of our old-timers got up, a real rugged sort of a guy, and he said, "You know, I get kind of sick and tired about all these guys getting up and saying they can't find God." He says, "You want to know something? He ain't lost." And remind that, I was looking frantically for God all these 2 years, believe me, wanting the bells to ring, the lights to flash. And God let him make himself known. He was there all the time, helping me over some almost unbelievable hurdles. I just didn't know it. He was there. Now, I was delighted to be able to tell this to that newfound friend of mine who was so desperately worried about his own future. You don't have to worry about it. You've got all the requirements to have to find the spiritual thing. I mean, you want to stay sober. You have a tremendous desire to stay sober. Your desire to stay sober is equal to your desire to survive. You've got what it takes. That will keep you open-minded and willing and honest. But the answer is right in the book, in the 12 steps. That's where we find it, putting them to work. And I admonished him a bit, the same as I had been admonished. I said, "Look, from my experience, when it comes to the 12 steps, they're truths. Truth. But you can take truth and you can examine it in a vacuum. You can contemplate it and study it. And the same with the 12 steps. You can read them in the private of your own room. And you can go to the meetings and you can talk about them and debate them. And you can hear long talks about them. And you can even begin to like them and know them." I says, "I think you could do those things forever. And not much would happen to you. But," I says, "you take those same 12 steps, whether you like them or understand them or not, and hurl your life after them, based on this desire to stay sober, and put them to work at the level of daily living, and practice them to the best of your ability, day after day. Whether you have much ability or not makes no difference." I said, "If you do that long enough, someday something will happen. Something wonderful will happen to you, and your whole life will change." And I said, "Someday you too will come to believe. I don't know how long it will take, but someday you'll come to believe. And you'll find that you're staying sober all the time you are seeking." I said, "Sure. In the beginning, you're going to have to lean upon your fellow AA members who seem to have the answer. But," I said, "eventually you'll learn to lean upon the power that stands behind us." I think AA is spiritual. Who could ever believe anything else? Those of you that were at St. Louis at the spiritual meeting and heard Dr. Sam, one of our greatest AA friends, when he said that day at the spiritual meeting that Sunday morning, he said, in his opinion, the greatest need for this troubled world was a vast worldwide spiritual awakening.
that he felt that Alcoholics Anonymous was a sign that such a thing was happening in our time. Now, he said, who could doubt but what that it was God that made AA what it is today, which made it tick. It was God that gave us this wonderful, intangible, but unmistakable spirit that's in all of our AA meetings, and it's here today with us now. Certainly, God is a part of this thing and is certainly spiritually sent. I was looking over history. History, throughout history, God has used human weakness to demonstrate his redeeming and healing power. All through history, he's picked out sometimes the worst elements to demonstrate his healing power. Most of us have heard of St. Paul. Who is he? He was once a great persecutor of Christians. He's the guy that stood by and watched young Stephen stoned to death without saying a word. But one day God caught up with him and changed him. And Saul, the persecutor, became St. Paul the Apostle, one of the greatest defenders of Christians that ever lived. Back in the 4th century, there was a fast-living young man called Augustine, who, in my opinion, must have been a lush, because he almost broke his mother's heart with his drunkenness and riotous living. And I think this young man, Augustine, finally hit bottom, like we did. And it changed him. God changed him. This higher power changed him. And Augustine the dissolute became St. Augustine, a great leader in Christianity. And it seems to me it's quite conceivable that God is using us AAs much the same way today, in this very troubled world of ours. Us alcoholics, people who call us the lost ones, children of the darkness, a people who have been complete and total failures at the business of living. It seems to me every AA member's life story of recovery has a tremendous lesson to give this materialistic world of ours today. And it's simply this, that God does use human weakness to demonstrate his power. That no man need to stay the way he is. That no failure ever need to be final. But with God's help, he can throw off the chains of any enslaving obsession and come out of the darkness into the sunlit world of the Spirit and again be free to be what God wants him to be. Thank you.